Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Assalamu alaikum, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me is Armin Navabi. Armin, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I am good. Thank you. I'm scheduled to get my AstraZeneca, my first shot, tomorrow. So,
okay.
Let's see how that goes. I won't say anything else about it. That's all I'm going to say. Just because, anyway. So, here we go. We're going to talk today about Joe Biden and Joe Biden's administration and how they're a demonstrable, like just a very, very noticeable, palpable U.S. foreign policy. I mean, this is something people around the world have had concerns about for a very long time, and now there's some shifts that are actually surprising me as well, because they're very different from the kind of thing that he was doing as vice president under Obama and also in previous years. So it's kind of interesting to talk about what's happening, why it's happening, and why it's happening now. So there have been several measures that he's taken. He's announced like some of these unprecedented changes to U.S. foreign policy, and he's still within his first 100 days in office. So he wants a full withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September 11th. That's one thing he said. He officially recognized the Armenian genocide this week, which has never happened. So he recognized it as a genocide, and that's going to anger Turkey, obviously. He has frozen arms sales to Saudi Arabia, something even Canada didn't do. Canada, I think, doubled. He's withdrawn U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. So standing up to Saudi Arabia is also kind of unprecedented for the U.S. Generally, that's something that they're not prone to do. He has talked tough on China and Russia. He even got Putin really mad by openly saying that he's a killer. I think it was a 60 Minutes interview when they asked him, do you think Putin's a killer? And he said, yes. So, and there are so many other things that are happening. I mean, his foreign policy towards the South Asia region, towards Iran. We've talked about some of that. And you know, just a lot of things in relation to this. So we're going to kind of look into some of these shifts and try to find a common theme and see why these shifts are happening now. And, you know, let's get into it. So, Armin, we've already had an episode here about Saudi Arabia and how they've changed in Saudi Arabia. So I want to start with that when we had Lujain Al-Hathloul, when she was released from prison, after pressure from the Biden administration, received a five-year sentence. It was commuted, and then she was out within weeks. And we talked about whether that was just a symbolic gesture and whether he's going to actually follow it up with real measures like, you know, addressing the atrocities that are happening in Yemen. And apparently he did. So it wasn't just like a show of something to quiet everybody down. So what do you think it is? Like, what is the U.S. thinking?
Okay, so, I mean, to be fair, there are a lot of people who are complaining that he is not going as far as he should. And to be honest, there's no anything that Biden would have done would have not been enough, given what Saudi Arabia has done.
Yeah.
However, it's more than I expected. I think so many people are so naive when it comes to Biden's pushback against Saudi Arabia. So the people who are blaming him for not doing more, there's two ways to look at it. Some of them are just anti-Biden, and it doesn't really matter what Biden does. They're just there to be anti-Biden. And they act sometimes like, well, if he did, like, we would be fair to him if he had actually done this. No. Anything he does, you are going to try to spin it in a way that is actually bad. However, there are some people who are doing this that are doing it the right way. Just because he's done something that we're happy with, that doesn't mean you shouldn't push for more, right? I would still want to push for more, right? Like, for example, it's fair to say why Biden, for example, so openly came out and called Putin a killer, right? He hasn't done that for MBS. And even when Anthony Blinken was asked directly, if are they going to call MBS a killer? He kind of dodged it. He didn't say it. He kept on highlighting all the pressure that they have put on Saudi Arabia. So why was the double standard is obvious. The double standard is expected. Saudi Arabia is still a major U.S. ally. And you don't want to completely destroy that relationship. But just because it's expected, are we not going to call it out? Are we not going to come and say it's hypocritical? No, we are going to do that. We have to do that. That's our job to do that. But at the same time, so it's hard to explain something without excusing it, right? Especially because people don't see the difference. They cannot, like, when you explain why something is happening, a lot of people think that you're excusing it. And we have to try to explain to them that these two things are not the same, right? So, for example, if the most extreme example of it, if I come in and talk about explaining where ISIS came from, that is not me excusing what they are doing. Like, even the most, the most horrible groups of people, if you come in and explain what's happening, right? So what I'm trying to say is that now if I'm going to explain, like, why United States is not directly putting sanctions on MBS, the explanation for that is that MBS is still considered a head of state, right? United States has basically done everything that you would have expected for them to do to put maximum pressure on Saudi Arabia, short of cutting ties with a major U.S. ally in a place where you need your allies to do more, because Biden's administration is trying to take away focus from the Middle East and focus more on Russia and China, right? So in an administration like Biden, that you have claimed that human rights is going to be a major issue for you, it's going to be a major thing that you're going to focus on, right? Again, I'm not taking their words for it, but they have said this, right? And so far, they have done more than most to show it. I'm not saying it's going to continue this way. I'm pretty sure Biden's going to do things that we're going to criticize here a lot. But right now, again, I'm sure we have so many areas of hypocrisy and double standards that we could point down to, even with Biden's administration. But there does seem to be some genuine push towards making human rights a significant part of the policy. If it's not the entire thing, but a significant part of it, at least at the beginning. Maybe it's going to change soon, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time that Biden administration is saying that they're going to make human rights an important issue, they're also making it a major part of the policy to not be that involved in the Middle East or in the countries around the Middle East. You cannot do that without having your allies more involved. So you're going to need Israel and Saudi Arabia and UAE and Qatar and Egypt. If you wash your hands off of it, right, without getting other people involved, you're gonna be dragged back in. You're going to be dragged back in. And in fact, given that the whole purpose of moving at, like, taking focus out of the Middle East to be able to focus on China is because China is a bigger thing bigger threat that they need to deal with. The issue is that if you come out and leave a vacuum, well, guess what? Now China is going to be more in the Middle East, right? So now Middle East will become a priority for you because the country that you were trying to focus on is now more involved in the Middle East, right? So, but here's the thing: the problem is that this is like a contradiction, because if you want these, if you want Saudi Arabia and Israel and UAE more involved, while at the same time you want to focus on human rights, well, they're not going to do the Saudi Arabia especially is not going to be more involved while making human rights at the top of their priority, right? So how do you do this dance of stepping out and also making human rights your priority? You, Ali, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I want to know, like, how much of this is this new administration, the Biden administration, how much of it is the fact that the whole geopolitical landscape in that region has changed? Like, if, for instance, because it, generally the doctrine of the U.S., I mean, I know that different presidents and different administrations had different doctrines, foreign policy doctrines, but generally, like, the common denominator, the common thread with all of their doctrines is that you do push for human rights, but you look at national economic interests first. So if there is a country that's violating human rights and, you know, you don't really have a big national or economic interest in them, then you can go and push for the human rights thing and you can be like the moral high ground. But if there's a country where you have national interests, like, you know, during the Soviet war, they had a national interest in Pakistan, and they actually enabled a lot of the Mujahideen and the jihadist fighters and everything. And then with Saudi Arabia, I mean, they supported Saudi Arabia for a very long time, unconditionally. Everybody said, well, they support Israel unconditionally. They actually supported Saudi Arabia even more unconditionally. And Saudi Arabia is one of the most repressive theocracies on the planet because they needed the oil. So now the pushback against Saudi Arabia, the pushback against some of these, you know, angering, like recognizing the Armenian genocide, like they don't really feel like they need Turkey anymore. During the Iraq war, they did need Turkey because they had, you know, the northern, they had their bases in southern Turkey, right, to go into Iraq. And now they don't really. So is it a matter of they don't really need the Saudis national interest wise? They don't really need Turkey. They don't need these people anymore. Is that more of a factor why Biden's feeling a little bit more like courageous, or is it, do you think it's actually a genuine shift in policy based on what he wants to do and prioritize?
It could be the fact that, so it's easier to care about human rights when economics are less of an issue. So the economics could still be a major factor, and you could still push against, you could still do things against your interests economically or against your interests political. Sometimes it happens in history, believe it or not. I know everybody is pessimistic and they think it never happens. It does happen sometimes where countries do something against their economic interest because of human rights. But the fact that the economic interests are less makes it easier to do that. You know what I mean? So the economic interest could still be there, but it's not as powerful as it used to be, right? Again, here's the thing. I'm not being naive, okay? Because a lot of people think this is naive. Everything is about money.
That's what all naive people say. They're like, I'm not being naive.
Yes. Okay. So maybe I'm being naive. Okay. But the thing is that, you know, as a politician, sometimes you do things that maybe economically it's not the best interest of your country, but politically it's good for your career. So if you want me to be pessimistic, here's some pessimism. Let's say like these people don't give a crap about human rights. Okay. If you want to be 100% pessimistic, you could look at it as like, okay, maybe for the country is not economically in their advantage, but for this politician's career, it makes a lot of sense. Good. Is that enough pessimism for you, for me not to be naive? There you go.
So let's take it specifically. So let's take two examples. Let's take Saudi Arabia, right? Initially, there was a lot of dependence on their oil. Now there isn't as much. What are the factors that are making the U.S. feel a little bit more comfortable, you know, and giving them more leverage against it? So that's one thing. And the second thing is, what about Turkey? This recognizing the Armenian genocide, right?
Right.
They've refused to do that. Like Obama didn't do it. No, nobody did it.
It's interesting that they didn't do it because the campaign promise was that they would do it, and then they didn't do it, right? So, I mean, this is, again, something that they all knew it was the right thing to do, but they didn't do it because Turkey's Turkey's as an ally was too strategic of a loss to for them to be like, you know, to be able to come and say this, right? Here's the thing. There is still some cost associated with alienating Turkey.
Right.
But the cost is less than before. Again, it's easier to do the right thing when the cost is lower than before. Yeah, exactly. It's affordable.
So what is that? What was the interest before that made them not do it? And how has that changed? What specifically with Turkey, for example, is...
Turkey is considered still, I mean, a major ally, right? It's a part of NATO. It has United States has a lot of bases in Turkey, and it's a major, you know, against Russia. It was considered a major ally that you don't want to like push into Turkey's hands. But as Turkey has played its hand to be more taking a bigger stance against Western countries, you know, it's a natural response. We're like, well, why do we have to play your game? Like, here's our response. Like, right. Mm-hmm. Like he's an easy thing we could do. I mean, among many other things, right? Like, so one reason why you want to not alienate Turkey is for them not to do the things that they have already done, like buy missiles from, or defense contracts with Russia instead of United States, right? So when Turkey goes ahead and does that, then there's less of a resistance for United States to do something that they already promised them. It's a campaign promise, right? I mean, it's an easy check mark, because here's the thing. A lot of people look at Biden's, you know, right now everybody wants to look at, oh, first 100 days for Biden. Let's see campaign promises and let's see how he has done. Like, oh, look, 4 out of 5. Not bad, not bad. Oh, when it comes to, you know, this 3 out of 4 when it comes to these promises, right? Like they like right now. So this is why, if you're looking at foreign policy, him saying that he's going to recognize the Armenian genocide as a genocide, is like, if he has made 5 promises for his 500 days, if not recognizing it would make him get a score of 3 out of 5 instead of 4 out of 5, why would he not upgrade to a 4 out of 5 instead of a 3 out of 5 to make it look like he's keeping more of his promises, while not losing that much in return, right? So again, see, I'm not being naive. It is within his political interest to look his first 100 days look like he's keeping more campaign promises. Like maybe for Obama, keeping that campaign promise was too high of a cost, right? But this is again is going to make, this is why, by the way, his approval is crazy high. But everybody noticed, like Biden's approval I mean, even AOC just, did you see AOC just came out? Okay, this is Biden. I don't know, he's having such a great time right now. I don't know when this honeymoon is going to be over, because everybody, like from most sides, like when it comes to left people from the left, both the pragmatic left-leaning people, the more corporate Democrats and progressives are like, oh yeah, I guess we're good. So okay, like AOC came out.
What happened to the AOC?
She just came out and says that Biden has been better than we expected for progressives. I was like, what? Even AOC is saying that. That's amazing.
He has been, and I think that even with a lot of Republicans, he's been, because I mean, we're not talking about this here. We're not going to focus on it, but his success with turning the pandemic around. Right. And I'm not going to say the keywords or anything like that, but I mean, that's actually really been phenomenal. Good. I mean, people that's here really in good. Canada are jealous, because Canada, they've completely screwed it up. It's been terrible. But okay. So I want to ask you, and this is, I'm asking you this stuff because I think that you tend to have a pretty good take on these things. And I do want to talk about, like, the Afghanistan troop withdrawal thing is a big story. So, you know, there's a lot there. And then also want to talk about China and Russia before the hour's over. But Saudi Arabia. So on the one hand, you know, the U.S. is not as dependent on Saudi oil, you know, thanks to fracking, thanks to some of the things that they've been able to do. The U.S. is relatively, you know, becoming more self-reliant when it comes to that old school fossil fuel energy and everything. But Saudi Arabia still is, you know, Israel is forming an alliance with Saudi Arabia. There is a strategic interest related to Israel. There's a strategic interest related to opposition against Iran. there are still strategic interests with Saudi Arabia. So is it the same kind of thing that the cost is just lower than it was before? That there is a cost, it's just more affordable?
Yes, and it's going to... I can't wait, by the way, for renewable energy. I can't wait the positions the United States is going to take against Saudi Arabia once it's going to be easier and becomes easier and easier to economically to stand for human rights, right?
Right, right.
But yeah, so yeah, I think the cost is more affordable, but also because of the more China. By the way, this whole thing might backfire. We're not like, I just want to make sure that we, I say this so that we don't get an, oh, you guys were wrong kind of situation, because like this whole stepping, like doing it focus on China might actually end up working better for China, may end up making it so that you know, China become Middle East becomes you know, China's playground, right? Especially given that how very little China can, I mean, guys, as much as you want, people want to say United States and Western European countries play a pretend game that they care about human rights, that even if it's all pretending, it's better than nothing. Okay. Like the fact that they have to play that game does save a lot of lives, right? It might just be for show, but it's a show worth playing. And China doesn't even need to pretend to play that game, right? So, I mean, China becoming more and more powerful and then China becoming the major player in the Middle East might open the door for so much more human rights violations that we have ever seen, right? So that's really scary, right? You know, and we're talking even China moving into Iran and making deal, big giant astronomical deals with Iran, is making these two countries closer together. And they already have been cooperating with coming up with technology to crack down on people, how to filter the internet, how to monitor people in Iran better. Like, this is going to be the technology that China is developing is going to be something that Iran will be taking advantage of. Right, we just recently had a leak that showed how much Russia and Iran are close with each other, and how much Russia uses Iran against against United States. That relationship might end up getting closer. We don't know, right? So
we're gonna do an episode on the leak. But can you mention? Yeah. Can you contextualize it? Because that's actually really, really big news.
This was a bombshell that just came out 2 days ago, that audio leaked out from Zarifa's conversation with this reporter, showing how much the IRGC is in control in Iran and how much the foreign ministry and the whole presidency as a whole is a complete joke with no influence and no say on anything, when it comes to foreign policy. Another major part of this leak showed how much Russia is in control in Iran's foreign policy, allegedly, and how much Russia is an instrument of trying to make sure that United States and Iran do not enter a deal. I mean, the interesting thing is that the conclusion of this idea was that the main highlight of this idea was that one something that we have been saying in this show is that it's within the best interest of both China and Russia for Iran and United States to be in conflict with each other, but not enough conflict for it to be chaotic, right? There is a sweet spot that they want to keep everything at, right? And the major reason why they want Iran to be in conflict with the United States is exactly why Biden is trying to end this conflict. Because according to the Russians, based on this audio leak, if United States manages to fix the relationship they have with Iran, they will start focusing on Russia and China. So the Russians think that a conflict between Iran and United States will keep United States foreign policy focused on the Middle East.
Like engaged.
Engaged. Again, they don't want war. They don't want outright chaos. They want stability in the Middle East, but they want conflict between Iran and the United States, but not outright war. So they are part of the negotiations so to end up avoiding a war, but also they want to make sure that there is not not complete understanding and not a complete negotiation between in these countries, which is so amazing. Yeah, we have to dissect that ideally as much as possible. And there's a whole bunch of other things that I'm not going to get into right now about that.
Yeah, right? No, we're going to talk about that in the future. I think the next episode after our Q&A, the first episode of May, will be on the audio leak. And we're probably going to know a little bit more about it then. I'm just surprised that it hasn't been covered in the news the way it should have been. I mean, this should be...
Being covered. No, this is a big deal.
It is. It's getting coverage. I mean, the only thing that I saw is that, okay, John Kerry's in trouble and all that. Like, I haven't really
seen CNN International, I saw, is covering it. The Guardian was covering it. People are not paying attention to it, but that doesn't mean they are not covering it. I want to respond to the Ali's question in the live chat. By the way, guys, if you're not a Patreon, when we go live, you could come join us live and ask your questions live with us. So link in the description. If you're watching this later, you could be part of the conversation while we're having this. So Dolly is a patron, and she's asking why. Dolly say in the live chat saying, "Do you want to answer this, Ellie? You want to read it first?"
Dolly is saying, "Why the West pretending they care about human rights while they're not?" Right. So I mean, we kind of touched on this a little bit.
Okay, so if you want me to respond to it, here's the thing. The West is a general term, Dolly. You cannot say that about the West because it's such a giant umbrella term that you're covering so many different people and so many different individuals and so many different politicians. There's no way you could make a judgment, pass a judgment on an entire... Like, you're not talking about even one country. I don't even know how you could say that. I don't even pass judgment on one individual like this, let alone one country, let alone multiple countries, right? So there are many institutions, politicians, and organizations, and lobby groups, and think tanks that care about human rights in the West, and many of them who don't, right? So this way of general, this is a very simplistic way of... By the way, this is not a good way for me to encourage people to become patrons. Yes, everyone, become a patron so I could mock your questions higher live on air.
No. But I got to say one thing, Dolly. I think that it's good that you asked this question because a lot of people do wonder this. Like, why does the U.S. do this when they don't care about human rights? I mean, they look at one thing, they're like, well, they're making such a big deal about some human rights issue here and in X location. But then when you look at the Saudi war in Yemen, they've supported it for years. You know, and they're giving them arms deals. So it's a legitimate question that, you know, people think, okay, do they care about it or do they not? And the thing is, like, you know, Armin's right. So if you look at the U.S., for instance, the U.S. has the highest number of people, who are doing humanitarian work, private citizens, private organizations, nonprofits, than any other country in the world. And they're traveling all over the world and doing all kinds of things for humanitarian reasons. So there's a big... there's a big sort of collective conscience in the U.S. public, the public votes, the U.S. electorate, about human rights issues, things that they feel strongly about. Of course, it is selective. You know, there's some things that they overlook and there's other things that they care about more. For example, nobody really cares about the human rights violations in Africa, for instance, in African countries. And that's a big, big blind spot for, I think, humanitarians everywhere. But the U.S., again, they have a tiered system. Like, how are they going to approach a region? They're going to look at strategic, economic, and national interests in certain regions. And if that trumps the human right issue, then they won't. They'll deprioritize the human rights thing. I mean, famously, I think Obama did an interview with Fareed Zakaria about Raif Badawi. I don't know, Armin, if you remember this, Fareed Zakaria was interviewing him. And he asked him, he's like, you know, when you go to visit the Saudis, are you going to bring up the issue of Raif Badawi? And Obama essentially said no, very politely. He's like, no, this is not the time to bring it up. Okay, now he would bring those kinds of things up with North Korea, for instance. He's not going to bring that up with Saudi Arabia. So there is a tiered system. It's not fair. It doesn't seem just. It seems hypocritical. But that unfortunately is the case. That doesn't mean that there isn't a push for human rights. I mean, they know that the American electorate cares for it. They know the American population, the voters care for it a lot. Lobbyists care for it. There's a lot of people. So politicians do have to play for it. They have to promise things, and they do have to eventually deliver on them. So it is a mixed bag, but it's not as clean as, you know, the U.S. doesn't care about human rights, or the West doesn't care about human rights.
By the way, I do want to mention that on the face of it, again, this we have to see how this plays out, okay? The pulling out of Afghanistan, again, if this doesn't play out the way we expect it, don't come at me and be like, "Oh, Armin, you were wrong." If, again, on the face of it, this is a major, major point for taking, like, keeping campaign promises over what would make sense economically, okay, for the United States. I don't know if people understand how much rare metals it's at play here when it comes to Afghanistan, okay? And how much going into the future, rare metals are going to be significant, both from an economic perspective, given the upcoming technologies that are coming, right? And especially in defense technology, right? And how significant of a power play it is right now for China. Because China itself has such a huge control over rare metals, the rare metal market. And that by itself has been something that China has used as leverage in foreign policy against not just United States, but also Japan and South Korea. And we're talking about, like, everything from, like, phones and, you know, everything, but especially in defense. So this is so significant, okay? So China already has a huge control over the rare metal market. This is something that is economically incredibly significant. The numbers are astronomical, okay? And we have seen at China how in foreign policy is, so it's not, for China, it's so obvious that economics and political power plays, they move between using these like no other country can, right? So in many other countries, because the economy is not in complete control of the government, you cannot use your economy the same way that China can when it comes to pushing other countries to do your bidding, right? Or to use it as a political power play. But China can't do that because it has a complete control over its companies, right? And we have seen examples of it. Like Japan and South Korea have seen examples of China using this against them, right? The rare metal market. And if you're not familiar with this, just go look it up. Like, this is a major, major issue. And the number, like, this is the oil of, you know how, like, oil is becoming, we're going to see at some point oil becoming less relevant when it comes to foreign policy, right? Because every time when we talk about relationship between countries and why Saudi Arabia, why this, you're like, oh, it's about oil. Like, and there's so many memes about, like, oh, you have oil, let's give you some democracy. And then, you know, this is such, people associate oil so much with how foreign policy is dictated, right? Well, think about the future. The future, that's going to be with rare metals, right? Especially the way technology is heading, right? And given that how important rare metal has been and is, and how much China uses that, Afghanistan is the Saudi Arabia of rare metals, okay? So, and given that Afghanistan is like the Saudi Arabia of rare metals, in such an important, and it's such important predictions about how this is going to play out. United States stepping out of Afghanistan and letting China to come and take over and becoming even more in control of rare metals. Seems such a bad move, both politically and economically. And yet, with all those interests in mind, Biden is like, oh, yep, this is a campaign promise that we're going to keep. So it just seems like, and then yet, even after all of that, idiots like Kyle Kalinske are going to have to come and spin it in a way that it's going to make Biden look bad. Like he is doing the thing that you guys want him to do. He is keeping a campaign promise. Like, you guys, like, don't, like, I'm like, I want to say something that is going to break TOS, so I'm not going to say it.
But what's TOS? Yeah,
Terms of Service, YouTube.
Right? Oh, okay.
Like,
okay.
But like, yeah, like, this is like something in Minecraft, okay? But like, God damn it, man. These people, they never get satisfied. But like, just imagine what I was going to say. Just think that. Yes, that, okay? Whatever you imagine. I was going to say.
I don't know anything about Minecraft. But so what is it then? Why do you so there's a national interest in Afghanistan. And this is the one that I want to talk about. There's so many layers to this. So you're talking about the rare metal thing. There's a clear national interest and economic interest in Afghanistan. But at the same time, you know, you've had the longest war ever in U.S. history. This thing started in 2002, I think. And it's been going on until now. So it's almost been 20 years. Longest war in U.S. history. Tremendous death toll, all kinds of things. And now you, it's like a full troop withdrawal by September 11th. So what is the reason for it? If there's this interest with rare metals, if there's this danger that China is going to consolidate its power in the region by coming in and taking control of it, and they're going to have what is the? And then there's also, of course, you know, the fact that the Taliban are going to essentially have power again. I mean, they're going to be able to commit all of the human rights abuses that they were doing before, all the treatment of women, all that whole thing is going to go back to the way it was. Right. There's no reason to think it's not. It's probably going to be worse than it was before.
Well, we don't know. Yeah, but
safe haven for jihadists.
It's a safe bet to make, but nothing is for sure. But yes.
Yeah, it's going to be a safe haven for jihadists. I mean, it's going to be prime. Like, that'll be the place that they can go now.
It's going to also, the whole thing with Pakistan next to it is going to be like, it's such a mess. Yeah.
It's a mess. So why? Why are they doing it? Is it just because the cost has been way too much of the war
in Afghanistan? Well, because it's unpopular with the Americans. And Biden wants to keep a campaign promise, right? It's basically that.
Right, but there's a lot of things.
It's as simple as that. These are examples of sometimes things happen that is happening because voters, like, a lot of people may tell you that what the voters want doesn't matter at all, okay? And the politicians are going to do whatever is in the best interest of military contractors and lobbyists. But I mean, we have a lot of examples of that. I'm not saying that doesn't happen. We have studies that shows that, yes, that is the case. What lobbyists and contractors want matters a lot more than what voters want, right? But we also have examples of sometimes things happening because a politician is giving what the base, its base wants and what it's promised them to do, right? But the thing is that the problem with the whole I don't want to say the problem because there are many problems, but the issue with the whole Afghanistan war is that the reason why the United States is there is different from what they tell people why they're there, okay? Because it's hard to be honest about why they are there, okay? So telling people that this is because of human rights makes people roll their eyes, right? Especially given, you know, but if you say the honest truth is that they're there because of strategic, you know, both political advantage and military reasons, again, you know, and also economic, right? We were talking about $1 trillion worth of I think it was $1 trillion worth of rare metals and stuff like that, and you want to just give that all up to China, right? And also being there, like, when people who look at the situation and know the United States doesn't want to just give that all up And then they come and say, like, oh, yeah, if women's rights, that's why we're in Afghanistan. Like, if you say that, people are like, well, we know this is not the reason why you're there, right? We know, like, but the truth is that women's rights will, there's like a, it's a safe bet to make that women's rights is going to suffer from if the United States pulls out of Afghanistan. But so you might, it might make sense for a lot of people to throw at that people like, hey, look, this is why we need to stay in Afghanistan. But given that people know that there's another reason for why they're there, it just comes off as so dishonest that no excuse for staying there is going to be accepted by the Americans, right? So here's the thing. If should you have been honest to your people for why you're there? Would that have worked? I mean, probably not. Like, think about when Trump said that, oh yeah, we're going to be in Syria to take their oil. If Biden, for example, said something like that, it would come off the same way. Like, people are like, oh yeah, we need to stay in Afghanistan because we need their rare minerals, right? I mean, people would be like, wait, what? We're losing American lives because of economic reasons? Like, so we're like, Americans are dying there. So because you want to make sure that we're economically better, like strategically stronger than China. And it's interesting, if he said that, he would have been attacked so aggressively. I mean, yet it would have been such an anti-China move that a lot of right-leaning people think would not expect from Biden. By the way, a lot of right-leaning people promised us that Biden is going to be China's puppet, and so far he's been the most aggressive one. So it's amazing how this is working out. But yeah, go on. Like, not just words, because Trump has been anti-China while making it things easier for China, but Biden in practice has been a lot more aggressive against China. Like, not just tweeting about it. I mean, the whole trade war with China ended up working in China's advantage, but I don't know. Like, also, you know, Trump's alienating himself from countries in that region, stopping that whole trade deal that was supposed to be the world's biggest trade deal. Like, that was such a win for China. Like, Trump has been a massive win for China, right?
Yeah.
And Biden coming up and building those relations, maybe getting into trade deals with more trade deals with Vietnam, Philippines, Korea, that is going to be more difficult for China to maneuver. So it's interesting, the person that is like tweeting more aggressively against China was better for China, and the person that is maybe holding back and talking more passively and saying stuff that is even horrible, like Biden said some horrible things that seemed that he was excusing China's human rights violations, right? But yet in practice, it was horrible, and we criticized it. We came out against what Biden said aggressively, right? But yet in practice, his administration is taking stances that are worse for China, right? So this is, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm saying, look, so I'm looking at this right now, the total cost of the war in Afghanistan, it's actually up to $1 trillion. It's not the same. So it has cost a lot, and it's cost a lot in terms of like U.S., and this is to the taxpayers, right? To U.S. taxpayers. So
yeah, that's a sunk cost.
Sure.
You can't use the sunk cost fallacy in the calculation on whether or not it makes sense. Again, I'm not advocating. I hope people don't think I'm advocating for staying in Afghanistan. All right, I'm just giving you the whole picture about what you're going to lose, what you're going to get. Right.
Try to do campaign promises, Armin. Like when they do that, like, okay, we're going to withdraw troops from Iraq. Then they'll announce that, oh, we've had, you know, we're removing all of our combat troops from Iraq, but they're really keeping a few of them in. They've got a bit of a skeleton crew. They're kind of maintaining their presence in the area and keeping an anchor in the region anyway. So there's ways to do it. So I'm not sure exactly what his plan is.
Yeah, but again, it's so stupid, because if they keep like 100 troops or like something, a small crazy number there, like small number, people are like, oh, you didn't pull out. Like, oh, really? They went from such a high number. Like, you're going to look at, like, you know, it's so stupid.
Well,
it's
then
like,
they haven't pulled out of Germany or South Korea either, right? I mean.
Yeah, I mean, come on. They like, are you serious? Like, you're going to, it's so stupid. Like, it's kind of like, I'm going to come up with an example. I just make it so stupid, right? Like, of course they're going to have, like, what are you going to do? Like, oh, you're going to go find, like, what? Oh, look, we found a staff member under the desk hiding. Like, oh my God, we found one American here, one American military in Afghanistan. That means they didn't pull out at all. Okay, sure. You could, like, they could be so, I don't know. Anal about it. But, they will come. It doesn't really matter. There are some progressives that just want to make Biden's administration look as bad as possible. It doesn't really matter what he does. They're more anti-Biden than any right winger could ever be. So it's very amazing. I do want to answer this. Do you want to answer this question by Dolly?
Yeah, let's take a look. Let's see. She's saying, I have a question. Why is the Russian army still in Syria? Are they still there? And how the situation in Syria affected U.S. and EU policies?
Obviously Russia is going to be in Syria. Russia is going to be in Syria because, well, Russia wants to make sure that it has leverage anywhere that it could make things difficult for the United States, right? Because that's how, when you have less power, when you have less of a military power, you have to, you fight your enemies in places, you have to spread them thin, right? You have to spread them in many places as much as possible where it's going to be, okay, so think about it like this, right? Let's say I have the most secure house, I'm armed to the teeth, I have the most advanced security, cameras everywhere, 2 Rottweilers outside, two personal bodyguards that live in house all the time. And it's basically, you know, you can't reach me, right? Like, I'm extremely secure, right? So you don't challenge me, right? You know that I have maybe business interests with Ali, right? Ali has like a store and I own part of Ali's store. And you go mess with Ali's store and you try to get me to come out of my house to come protect Ali's store. Like, okay, I send one of my bodyguards to Ali's store to make sure Ali's store is not attacked. And I'm like, okay, well, I also find out that you're friends with Susanna. So let's go, like, go over there. I also found out that you have friends over here. Let's go. Like, I went, okay, you could borrow my Rottweiler. Oh my God, you could go and get my, you could get, remove one of my security cameras and put it over there, right? So you just were like, I'm not strong, I don't have enough resources to come at your house and like bully you there. I'll just make you spread yourself thin as much as possible, right? And that's how we're not like enemies. I just want to, you know, we're just competitors, and I just want to make sure that, you know, I have some leverage over you, right? So maybe if you give me some share in Ali's store, I will stop bothering Ali. You know what I mean? So this is a way for somebody that has less military power to be able to fight an asymmetrical warfare, right? So to be able to spread an empire thin in a way that it makes it easier for you to fight a giant superpower by trying to attack its interests. And here's the thing. Well, a lot of people say, well, it's easy then to respond to that if you don't want that to happen, is just not to have interests outside of your house. Just bring everything home. Why are we in Afghanistan? Why are we in Lebanon? Why are we in Germany? Why are we in South Korea? Just bring everybody home, focus on home, and nobody could poke at you in all these places. Well, that's easier said than done, right? Because your economy depends on your relationship with these other countries, right? And to be able to have trades with these countries, to be able to continue your, you know, so it's not, you need to be able to secure trading routes. You need to be able to, for your allied countries to have stability. So even if you want to focus on home, your economy at home depends on the safety of trading routes within different oceans. Your economy at home depends on certain stability on your trading partners. So you know, so it does make sense for you to invest. Again, I'm not saying maybe you're over invested. So you could argue like, okay, fine. It makes sense for you to have like some Navy in this sea to make sure that China, because imagine if you pull everything and you have no army anywhere on any of these places, right? Well, China is not going to dominate this canal over here where so many of the goods that come to the United States passes through, right? So now the China is going to be able to block that anytime it wants. Right? What are you going to do now? All right? It's not that simple. Okay? I'm not saying that United States is everywhere the United States is makes sense. I'm just saying it doesn't make that much sense. It's not that simple for you to completely pull out of everywhere. Right?
Right. So let's go, like, we have a little more than 10 minutes left. So I wanted to actually talk about it. We're talking about China throughout anyway. So let's talk about China. So the Biden administration has been, and people are actually upset about this. I mean, they've pretty much, in a way, I mean, Trump did get combative with China, and Biden is sort of continuing that in a way, in different ways. So they had the meeting, the U.S. officials and Chinese officials. They met in Alaska, I think in March, late March. And again, Antony Blinken, right? And that's the U.S. Secretary of State.
Right.
Started talking about the whole issue that's happening with the Uyghurs and the Xinjiang province. He's talked about the Hong Kong political, you know, the crackdown on political dissidents. He talked about Taiwan. So they've actually referred to, like Trump used to do. I mean, the U.S. never used to refer to Taiwan as a country, right? Because they didn't want to piss off China. And now Trump did that. And now, you know, Blinken did the same thing. So the Biden administration is referring to Taiwan as a country. And that's something that really bothers China. It's causing issues with them. So they went and they talked about the human rights thing. China came back and they said that, you know, the U.S. is really big on cyber attacks, and, you know, they have high incarceration rates. It's not, you know, that they don't have confidence in the democracy of the United States. So it was a pretty contentious meeting, right? It was a place where they're supposed to just sort of state their positions, but it became combative and it became a big issue. And there are critics, actually, and this is a bipartisan criticism, that there are critics who are saying that the U.S. can't afford to do this. I mean, these are the two most powerful countries in the world right now. There's a lot of dialogue that they're pissing off China way too much. Why is Biden doing it? What is he thinking?
What do you mean they can't afford to do this? They can't afford not to do this.
I'm just a messenger. I get it.
Yeah, yeah.
The time is now. I agree, but it has consequences. It has economic consequences. Like, you know, the withdrawal from Afghanistan. So you're saying allowing, like, making it fertile ground for China to come and take over. So there's a lot of aspects to this. Right?
It's so amazing because I also watch right leaning channels that were waiting for Biden to bend the knee to China, and now that Biden is being aggressive to China, I'm trying to see their spin on it. And they described that meeting. They were like, "Oh my God, it was so embarrassing. They let the Chinese, you know, delegation. They were like talking so aggressively to Blinken, and it was so humiliating for him to sit there and just watch." Like, what are you talking about? He also said something back to them, and he was on point with his response. What do you want him to do? Do you want, when they are like, when the Chinese delegation, when they were talking aggressively against Blinken, you wanted him to what? Like, stand up and like throw something at them? Like, what? he just stood there and took it, as opposed to what? When he was his turn, he was responded, and the response was amazing. You want him to like attack him physically? Like, what do you?
Well, he's also been meeting with.
It's so insane. It's like there's nothing. It's such a. Everybody is just like. Their spins on everything is so predictable, right?
It
like,
is predictable. Yeah, because it's partisan. When it's partisan, it's predictable. You know exactly, if you know like what they think about nuclear policy, you can tell what they think about abortion. I mean, it's absolutely idiotic. Like, those two things aren't even connected.
So the progressives are going to be like, oh, yeah, you pulled out of Afghanistan, but not really. Like, okay? And then the right-leaning people are like, oh, my God, you act like you're being tough to China, but not really. Like, it doesn't matter what they do. Your opinions are going to say exactly how they were. Like, I'm convinced that these right-leaning people, some of them, Biden could start an outright war with China, and they're going to be like, oh, you're still like a Beijing puppet or something. Like, it doesn't matter what happens on the ground. Their opinions are going to stay the same.
Well, he's trying to build like a sort of a coalition. I don't know if the coalition is the right term. He's meeting with people from with India, along with India, Japan, Australia, all of these countries that are in the region, and they're concerned about the increasing influence of China in the region. So Biden is actually reaching out to all of these countries to sort of talk about this. Yeah.
Best thing you could do against China right now is to build, to make, strengthen your relationships with all your traditional allies, all of them. Okay.
Yes.
And that's exactly the opposite of what Trump did. And this is exactly what Biden is now trying to mend. And he's doing a good job at it. I mean, when it came to Western European countries, it was instant, right? I mean, taking a tougher stance against Iran is becoming easier. You know, again, against Iran, like, if you want to, like, Trump, by the way, I have to say this very easy, okay? A lot of people are saying, oh, my, Biden is going back into that deal, that disastrous deal, and this is exactly why he shouldn't have been elected, blah, blah, blah. And these are the people who supported Trump, while Trump openly admitting that the whole point of taking a stronger stance against Iran was to go back to the deal with more favorable terms, right? Trump mm-hmm. openly had said that he wanted to go back to that deal himself, okay, with better terms for the United States. Well, guess what? You're not going to get that better terms, because you're not going to be able to pressure Iran if you don't have your allies backing you up. If there is ever a better deal, which I don't know if there's going to be the same deal, a better deal, okay? If there's ever going to be a better deal, it's going to be a better deal because the United States had its allies on the same side backing it up, backing the United States up. And Biden can do that. Trump alienated its ally, right? So Biden is doing exactly what Trump wanted to do and failed. Okay, and this is, again, I'm not saying this is not going to fail. It might fail. Right now, the situation is very complicated, and we might want to do an entire stream on that as well when it comes to the U.S.-Iran deal. But if there's any ever a chance of getting a deal that is better in United States' interest, it's going to be with the partnership of your European allies, right?
What should the U.S. policy be towards China? Because I'm confused. I am actually genuinely confused about this. I first of all, I don't know that much about it. I know the CCP is, you know, you've talked about the top six threats to everything, and you include the CCP there. But if you do what Trump, if you can kind of continue that and you start doing all this tough stuff on China, closing their consulates, like doing all these other things, you know, the exchange students, Fulbright scholars, all of that, all of those programs that the U.S. has suspended, and you continue to isolate them, aren't you kind of pushing Russia and China together? And isn't that a bigger threat against your allies? I mean, if you have Russia and China, they're together, right? Then you have, you know, Japan and Australia and, you know, all these other countries, India, aren't they going to be feeling more vulnerable at that point? So what does the U.S. do? How does it offset that issue?
Well, I mean, right now, the way that it was working was that you weren't just pushing Russia into China's arms, you were pushing everyone into China's arms, the way Trump was going, right? Mm-hmm. You know, but
what has changed, though? How is that not happening now?
I mean, for example, going back into what Obama was trying to do, making better, having better relationship with countries, especially around China, right? So, for example, the Philippines, for example, was breaking ties with the United States and getting closer to China, right? Now that's reversing. Now China is, Philippines is going back to United States, so like, please come save us from these Chinese. They're taking away our islands, right? So coming back to like, I'm sorry, I never left you. Come, please take me back. it's not, okay, by the way, here's the thing. The idea is not to like push away Russia and China. Because China is like a major trading partner with the United States, okay? You know, you want, it's in the best interest of United States for China to do better, for China to become more economically stronger, okay? But it is in the best interest of United States, and it's the best interest of China for United States to become economically stronger, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So the aim is not to push away China. The aim is to move from a hostile competition to a friendly competition. You know what I mean? And you do that by, you know, trying to ease up the tensions and try to have alternatives to China, and try to also, you know, build better, you know, trading relationship. So you need to pull back away from China where they are making a mistake, but also leave a door open to make it seem like it's easy to come back in if you fix this, if your human rights is okay over this, if you're not aggressively making moves against our positions here, the door is open for us to have good relationships. Like, so again, I'm not saying the I'm not in favor of like anti-China policy. Like, you need to have anti-Chinese positions policy, right? Not an entire anti-China policy.
Do you think that he's doing that? I guess last question, we're at an hour now.
It seemed like that's the philosophy because
It doesn't seem like it. I feel like he's being a lot more. I think it's causing
So he does, at least the wording of it seems to be like that's the goal. Okay.
Right.
But again, we just started. Like, given how much China has been like acting like a bully around the region, I think the first reactions need to be like, we're not going to deal with this. Like we're not just going to stand and let you act like this. And then maybe move into, it seemed like the philosophy of the administration is what I mentioned, but we don't know. We'll see. By the way, I just want to do mention before we end this here as well. A lot of people do have questions and they are not able to join us live here. So you can, as a Patreon, you can send us your questions before we go live. So we can answer them live on air, right? So if you, I know a lot of people can
just post your questions on the Patreon, the link.
Yes, yes. So if you're a Patreon and you're like, yeah, sorry, I can't join you live. Well, you can sell, like, if you see a topic and you have a question regarding that, as a Patreon, you can send us your questions and we'll make sure we answer them live on air.
Yeah. All right.
Also, so we're planning on increasing our public Q&As as well. So that's coming up.
Right. So we're going to start doing two of those. I don't know. And I guess we'll talk about what the format and everything for that will be. But for now, all you need to know is in 3 days on April 30th, on the last day of the month, we're going to have our public Q&A. That's not just going to be for patrons. It's going to be for everybody. So please bring your friends, bring drinks, do whatever you need. And you can ask about anything and everything. And we will answer your questions as long as they don't break the YouTube terms of service. Right? Right, Norman?
Yes, exactly.
So there's certain questions.
YouTube's getting worse.
YouTube's getting worse. So, if you like what you hear here, if you're interested in this stuff, and if you want to watch it live, if you want to participate, if you want to ask questions, please consider becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/SJME. And you can sign up for as little as $1 a month, and you get 5 episodes every month. You get to watch it all on video. You get to ask questions. Your questions are prioritized. So just absolutely go ahead and do it. Now, if you can't become a patron, that's perfectly fine. You know, take links to the public versions of these podcasts, share them, go to iTunes, give us a rating, if you're watching this on YouTube, hit the subscribe button, hit the bell so you get a notification, and please do subscribe to Secular Jihadists. And
Just a note, I also just checked how much the rare metals in Afghanistan is worth. It is $1 trillion. I was correct about
it. Just wanted
to brag about being correct about that.
Harman's almost always right. Almost always right. So anyway, thank you, everybody. Thank you all for joining us. This was really, really interesting. We are going to have a future, probably the next episode we're going to have is going to be about the leaked audio. From Iran, this is Jawad Zarif's conversation, which, did he leak it himself? Who leaked it? We
don't know. Oh, yeah. We're going to find out. Yes, Armin is going to elucidate all of those details when we when we speak again. So, and I'm going to sort of go ahead and listen to some of it too, or at least read about it if I understand the language. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We're going to see you April 30th, live Q&A for everybody. We're going to announce it and publicize it. Tell your friends, bring them.
Be best, everyone.
Be best. Hashtag.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends, write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions, or head over to secularjihadist.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.